There once was a man called Vitruvius. His influence was very hugeous. He served under Caesar, designing machinas, and wrote a book called De Architecturis.
Nice, nice.
That was good.
Welcome.
That was good.
Welcome back to the Renaissance episode 126, my little furry friend. How are you today?
Doing good. How are you?
Oh, I'm good.
You ready to get deep, metaphysical?
Yeah. You know me, I love going deep. Yeah.
Bring back the ancients, not anal, but ancients. So this is going to be awesome. Yeah.
I caught up with my 84-year-old friend, Peter Elliard, and his 74-year-old partner, Robin. Sure. On the weekend, on Wednesday, down at the Gold Coast, they're up visiting from Melbourne. And Robin said, "So what are you working on at the moment?" I said, "Well, blah, blah, blah." And I said, I'm about to do like a couple of hours on Vitruvius."
Right.
And talked about who he was and the Vitruvian man. And they're very well educated, very smart people. She said, "Oh, that sounds great. I should listen to that. And you have to send me a link." And I was like,
"Yeah.
No. No.
I want to keep you as a friend.
I don't think, think you want to hear this." And she's like, "Why not?" I go, "Well, it's very, very crude, our podcast." And right. Explain. And Chrissy was like, yeah, it's disgusting. And she's like, "Yeah, okay, maybe not then." And yeah. I was going to ask you this. I was thinking about it as I was driving home. I was like, do you spend most of your time convincing people not to listen to these podcasts? Because I find that that's what I'm doing. People go, "Oh, I want to listen to that." I'm going, "No, you probably don't.
You really don't. You say you do, but you don't.
You say you're cool. Right? You say I don't mind a bit of swearing, but really this is..."
Yeah, this is not cool. This is...
Begs the question, as Chrissy always says, stop with all the swearing and the stupid, crude talk, and you'll be much more successful. I'm like,
that's the way it works. That's the way the brain works.
It's just we have too much fun doing it.
I see your face on the screen, and fuh, just comes out. So thank you for the advice.
Okay. Yeah. This is the story of the most famous drawing in the world. Not a tribute.
No.
This is the story of the greatest song in the world. Tribute. No. Well, there was kind of a tribute.
This is the story of a man and a lady who had three kids of his own. Brady Bunch, something? It's in there. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry. The most famous drawing, yes.
If you were, you know, as clever as I am, I wrote a limerick. You could have rewritten the Brady Bunch lyrics.
Oh,
this is the story of a man called Vitruvius. Yes. And his 10 books on architecture. Anyway, the most famous drawing in the world.
Yes.
And it was inspired by a man called Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. Vito Corleone, born around... Because I got tired of writing Vitruvius in my notes, so I just call him Vito from now on.
Yeah, I call him Vito.
Born around 80 BCE.
Right.
By the way, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
I am sick to fucking death of having to put an E at the end of BC when I'm writing my notes. Every book that I am, you know, getting stuff out of, spoiler alert, I get all my knowledge from books. They still, to this day, and these are contemporary books often, written in the 21st century, some of them.
Yeah.
Still are using BC instead of BCE. What the fuck is up? And here's my theory on this. Mm-hmm. It's that they're published in America, and American publishers don't want to upset Christian audiences by secularizing BC into BCE. That's my theory.
Well, the short version of that exact same answer, which is what I was going to give you, was two words: Catholic Mafia. So you don't want to upset them. You really don't. Speaking of the
Catholic Mafia, I'm getting way off track, but the this guy, the American head of the Council of Bishops, who was pushing for Joe Biden to
not get
banned from communion, because of his liberal stance on abortions,
to let women have free choice. Go ahead.
Properly resigned this week when it was leaked
Right.
By someone, and we don't know who. It was leaked that he attends gay bars, and they used mobile phone data to track him to gay bars and showed that he was using Grindr.
Right.
Now, he was a pain in the ass to Joe Biden. And yes. Now, I'm not suggesting that Joe Biden got on the phone to the head of the NSA and said,
dig up
Monsignor's mobile phone records and find anything that we can destroy him with. Not suggesting that happened at all. Sure, that would never happen in a Biden administration.
Having said that, somebody did something. Now, I'm in gay bars all the time, but that's just for the buffet. So, but I think for him, it was probably something different.
And this is probably going to go to a bullshit filter. And if for people wondering what's happening with the bullshit filter, I am working on a mega series of shows on COVID. We did a COVID show over a year ago when it first happened. We haven't done one for a long time. I'm doing a COVID update. I'm preparing for a COVID update. I should have probably told you about this. I'll give you last minute notice. So COVID, the vaccines, are the vaccines effective? What's happening with Delta and Lambda?
And Gamma. Because I get
Gamma?
There's a new one.
Yeah. That's the one that turns you into the Incredible Hulk when you get hit by it.
Race smash.
I am going to come out with that as soon as I get fucking time to scratch myself. As soon as I get a week where we're not doing one of these shows, I'm gonna get ready and do that show, and I'll let you know. So schedule it in. I think you'll be on vacation that week, so I might have to do it without you.
Right.
You're going on vacation again soon, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, you don't have to put it anyway. Yes. Be heading to the beach soon, but trying to dodge the COVID as we're going.
Your monthly vacation.
Back to
Vito Corleone.
Yes, V-Dog.
Yes, he served in the Roman army under Julius Caesar, Big JC, Big Julie, sort of an engineer, designed and constructed artillery machines, job that Leonardo himself would have loved if Leonardo could get a TARDIS, and quite frankly, I'm surprised Leonardo didn't invent the TARDIS. He would have gone back and said, "Oh, everyone, stand back, hold my beer, let me do this." Never actually done it before, but man, have drawn some.
Doesn't matter.
I can draw them.
I can imagine it. I can draw it. I can do it.
Yeah. I'm sure there's no difference between drawing it and actually building it. I mean, knows that.
I think you're right.
Vito also was involved in transporting equipment around Gaul and
Big
Spain.
Deal. Yes.
Building bridges over rivers. We know Caesar loved a good bridge. digging ditches, sinking wells, fighting battles, repairing siege engines, surveying land, laying out new towns that JC was setting up, founding colonies.
Bathhouses.
You name it.
Yeah.
He was doing
it. Yeah. He had a sign on his desk that said, kind of a big deal. So, I mean, because we know that, one, the Romans were engineers first and warriors second, so he takes care of the tools. That's a big deal. And also, he would lay out the camps that they have, the campsites. And as we know, it's most of the time when the Romans went into some place, they were outnumbered. If it wasn't for their campsites protecting them while they rested or while they slept or while they tended to their wounded, they would have been in a lot of trouble. So this guy is a big deal, and it's someone that can be trusted by someone like Caesar, who is intelligent, who can do this time and time again, who gets these kind of jobs. So obviously this guy was top-notch and very intelligent, and yet at the same time, very hands-on. Like you said, Leo would have loved him.
Yeah, he actually had the goodies slogan on his desk. I can do anything, anywhere, anytime.
It's a long sign, so, but still, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to be specific.
It's a big desk, so don't worry about it.
Yeah,
it'll fit.
So he eventually ends up as an architect, Vitruvius, and built a temple in the town of Fano in Italy. Fano's right up on the sort of the east side of the boot.
Due north of Rome.
Ancient town of Marche. There was a temple of Fortuna located there, so it was known as Fanum Fortuna. For a while, first mentioned in history dates from 49 BCE when Julius Caesar held it along with Pisaurum and Ancona.
Right.
And then Augustus built a colony there. The temple that Vitruvius built, unfortunately, no longer stands.
Too bad.
But the book that he wrote around 20 or 25 BCE, or the books, the right. 10 books of architecture known as De Architectura, I like saying that, does, thanks to our old friend Poggio Bracciolini, who we talked about God knows how long ago on this series.
Yes.
If you want to know more about that story, listen to episode 54 in May, from May 2019, two and a bit years ago. We told the story of Poggio discovering De Architectura.
Right. In 1414, he also, I think we covered this as well, he found Lucretius's On the Nature of Things and Cicero's Orientations. Oration. So I think, it like Oprah, you should probably say all these were discovered by Poggio Bracciolini. You know, something like that. I mean, major, major discoveries by this guy. And of course, Vitruvius's work was found in a monastery in Switzerland. This guy traveled. He deserves everything, all the credit that he can get. And by the way, for the monks that copied this out, the incel monk that copied this out, we just want to say thank you very much.
Now, it is the only surviving book or series of books,
right?
On architecture from classical antiquity.
Damn.
And I have a copy of it. And I'm going to read bits of it here so you get a sense for how it comes across. It's dedicated to Augustus. He wrote it during the reign of Augustus, as I said before, 2025 BCE. Here's the intro. While your divine intelligence and will, Imperator Caesar, were engaged in acquiring the right to command the world, and while your fellow citizens, when all their enemies had been laid low by your invincible valor, were glorying in your triumph and victory, while all foreign nations were in subjection, awaiting your beck and call, and the Roman people and Senate, released from their alarm, were beginning to be guided by your most noble conceptions and policies, I hardly dared, in view of your serious employments, to publish my writings and long-considered ideas on architecture for fear of subjecting myself to your displeasure by an unseasonable interruption. But when I saw that you were giving your attention not only to the welfare of society in general and to the establishment of public order, but also to the providing of public buildings intended for utilitarian purposes, so that not only should the state have been enriched with provinces by your means, but that the greatness of its power might likewise be attended with distinguished authority in its public buildings, I thought that I ought to take the first opportunity to lay before you my writings on this theme, for in the first place, it was this subject which made me known to your father, to whom I was devoted on account of his great qualities. After the Council of Heaven gave him a place in the dwellings of immortal life and transferred your father's power to your hands, my devotion continued unchanged, as I remembered him inclined me to support you. And so with Marcus Aurelius, Publius Minidius, and Gnaeus Cornelius, I was ready to supply and repair ballistae, scorpiones, and other artillery, and I have received rewards for good service with them. After your first bestowal of these upon me, you continued to renew them on the recommendation of your sister. Owing to this favour, I need have no fear of want to the end of my life. And thus being laid under obligation, I began to write this work for you because I saw that you have built and are now building extensively, and that in future also you will take care that our public and private buildings shall be worthy to go down to posterity by the side of your other splendid achievements. I have drawn up definite rules to enable you, by observing them, to have personal knowledge of the quality both of existing buildings and of those which are yet to be constructed. For in the following books I have disclosed all the principles of the art.
Nice. Now,
yes.
No, I was just going to say, for those of you who are looking for a job, take the first 55 words of that, make a couple changes. That's how you write a cover letter. I guarantee you'll get the job. You just plant the lips and kiss hard. That was an incredible opening on his part.
Yeah. No, so basically what he's saying is through all the work that he did for Augustus and Julius, he got rich like a podcaster. And was able to devote all of his free time to doing some good in the world, just like us.
But you made a good point at the end. I didn't think about that before. Here's Augustus, you know, turning Rome into a city of marble. A lot of building projects, yada, yada, yada. And so you need the science of architecture broken down, written down, organized, and then disseminated. So again, this is going to come in handy for everybody who comes after this work is put out. Not to say that there weren't other books, obviously, but this guy knows what he's doing. So this is something that's going to benefit. What the hell is that? That's going to benefit Rome in general. QV, is that, say QVW? What is that?
QAV, man.
QAV, I'm sorry, the lighting is a little... Nice! You got QAV tattooed on your ball. Golf ball! Sorry.
It's our official QAV merch, golf balls.
I need to get that. That's cool.
Yeah, I'm sending them out with a coffee mug, QAV golf ball and a coffee mug to all of our new subscribers.
Nice. Yeah.
Yes, so he does. He needs to know how to... Now, whether or not Augustus ever read the book,
he had someone else
we don't know.
He had a freedman read it. I ain't got time.
Probably.
Yeah.
Now, the first chapter of the book is... The first book.
Right.
Chapter book, but it was a book. 10 books.
Right.
The first book is about the education of an architect.
Mm-hmm.
He says an architect should be educated, skillful with the pencil, instructed in geometry, know much history, have followed the philosophers with attention, understand music, have some knowledge of medicine, know the opinions of the jurists, and be acquainted with astronomy and the theory of the heavens.
So a Renaissance man.
Pretty much.
Because the very first words, I just want to read this real quick. The very first words in the book, right after the introduction that you read, is just this. The architect should be equipped with a knowledge of many branches and study and varied kinds of learning, for it is by his judgment that all work will be done by other arts is put to the test. This knowledge is the child of practice and theory. So again, you need to know a lot, you need to have done a lot, you need to have experienced and studied a lot. Only then can you call yourself like an architect. And that would have made Leo smile because he's like, yeah, that's me. That should be on my t-shirt right now. I mean, it's a perfect representation of the man that's coming.
Yeah, he's speaking his language,
exactly.
Right? And then he goes on in the first chapter to explain exactly how and why you need to do all of those things. The second chapter is about the principles of architecture. Then he goes on to talk about the best site for a city, what to look for in a good site, how to design a city, how to build the walls, lay out the streets, the best sites for public buildings, etc. Sorry, those are both in book one. Book two is about the various kinds of building materials and their strengths and weaknesses.
Wow.
And he opens this book by talking about an old friend of ours, Dinocrates.
Right.
Invented dinosaurs and crates. And dinosaurs that come in crates were his specialty.
Well, that's safety.
How else are you going to ship them? Exactly. You've got to ship them somehow.
Just put them on a leash.
Yeah.
Did work in Jurassic Park. Go ahead.
We haven't talked about Dinocrates in this show, but we did talk about him in our old Alexander the Great show.
Right.
Listeners of our old Alexander series, and if you haven't heard it, then seriously, what the fuck are you?
It's a thing of beauty.
What are you doing?
Right.
Might remember this story. According to Vitruvius, Dinocrates was a young architect from Macedonia who wanted to work for Alexander. So he left Macedonia, just marched day and night over fjord and stream and valley.
Right.
And he's saying, and I will walk 500 miles and I will walk 500 more just to see your buttle shining in the sun, Alexander, I'm your whore. Ha la 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 la
la la la la la la la la la la. Now I'm going to have that song in my head for the rest of the night. I thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So he gets to Alexander, finds him, he's on campaign somewhere, and asks to be presented to him. I want to offer Alexander my services. I'm the world's greatest architect.
Right.
And he's told, sure, sure, no problem. You're going to have to wait your turn. Days go by. He doesn't get an audience with Alexander.
Oh.
Because Alexander's busy. You know, he's a busy man. He's got buttholes to fuck and, campaigns to design.
But there was another architect he was talking to before that. I think his name was George Costanza. And after a couple of conversations, Alexander's like, I don't really think you are an architect. No, I am, sir. I went to the school. So anyway, that didn't pan out. So hopefully it goes better for this guy. So
after waiting several days and not getting an audience, he decided to take matter in his own hands. And this is what Vitruvius says. He was of very lofty stature and pleasing countenance, finely formed and extremely dignified. Trusting, therefore, to these natural gifts, he undressed himself in his inn, anointed his body with oil.
I like this.
Set a chaplet of poplar leaves on his head, draped his left shoulder with a lion's skin, and holding a club in his right hand, stalked forth to a place in front of the tribunal where the king was administering justice.
Is he going to a costume party? Because if he is, he's going to win first place. I mean, that's Fred Flintstone.
If you want to get Alexander's attention.
Oh, lion.
You got to get naked and oil yourself up.
Grease up. Oh, my God. I'm semi-erect now. It's working.
Listen to the kids out there. Understand your audience is what he's saying. If you're applying for a job, steal Vitruvius's first paragraph top of your CV.
Yes.
Then understand your audience. If your prospective boss is into naked, oiled up young men.
Like a priest?
Just give him what he wants.
Exactly.
Give a bishop. President of the Council of American Bishops. Give him what he wants. Give him what he wants.
Yeah. Get his attention.
Doesn't matter. Like, just take one for the team. Exactly. Yeah, you are the team. Take one for yourself. You know? It's okay. What are you putting up a fuss about?
You can either have a great resume or you can have a sweet ass. I know which one I've chosen. I should have said that.
Anyway, just imagine you're in prison.
Exactly.
Or in Vegas. Anyway, he continues. His strange appearance made the people turn round, and this led Alexander to look at him. In astonishment, he gave orders to make way for him to draw near and asked who he was.
Right.
Dinocrates, quoth he, a Macedonian architect who brings thee ideas and designs worthy of thy renown. I have made a design for the shaping of Mount Athos into the statue of a man, in whose left hand I have represented a very spacious fortified city, and in his right a bowl to receive the water of all the streams which are in that mountain so that it may pour from the bowl into the sea.
That's impressive. I'm just saying.
Now, Mount Athos is the mountain and peninsula in northern Greece in central Macedonia. Alexander was impressed.
Yeah.
But immediately asked if there were any fields near Mount Athos that could grow corn.
Right.
Dinocrates said, let me get back to you on that one.
Let me look that up on Wikipedia. Anyway.
Alexander said, according to Vitruvius, I appreciate your design as excellent in composition and I am delighted with it, but I apprehend that anybody who should found a city in that spot would be censured for bad judgment. For as a newborn babe cannot be nourished without the nurse's milk, nor conducted to the approaches that lead to growth in life, so a city cannot thrive without fields and the fruits thereof pouring into its walls, nor have a large population without plenty of food, nor maintain its population without a supply of it. Therefore, while thinking that your design is commendable, I consider the site as not commendable. But I would have you stay with me because I mean to make use of your services.
An ass.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Now, what's underneath that lion skin?
That's right.
Give me the club. Bend over.
That's why Alexander's the king. He is wise. He doesn't get carried away unless he's got an arrow in his lung. It's like, no, it's a good idea, but everybody around you would die because there's no place to grow crops. See, you got to look at the big picture. That's why I'm the king. Well, that and I helped arrange the death of my father. But let's not focus on that right now. Just show me that sweet club of yours.
Listen, nice design, but honestly, you didn't really think this through, did you? You came all the way. You've been walking for 6 weeks.
Over the fjords. Really? Right.
You didn't think this through a little bit more before you...
Yeah.
Like, you went to all this trouble, you hauled yourself up, the lion skin, the club. I admire that, but really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you thought this through about as much as... Cassius and Brutus thought about the assassination of Julius
Caesar. Step one. There's only one step. Yeah.
Well, at least when I conspired with my mother to have my father assassinated by his former gay lover.
That's a rumor.
I knew what was going to happen next. I was going to be king, and jump I was going to take over and kill all my relatives.
And I did.
So I didn't have any threats, and I did. So, you got to know what the step two is. That's why... That's why people remember me 2,500 years later, and Cassius and Brutus.
Not so much.
Not so much.
Do you want to know the name of my treatise that's coming out? It's called The Second Step. It's critical. Yeah. It really is critical. Yeah. Anyway, so this poor young man.
Step two. That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Step two for you. Step two.
Electric Boogaloo. I don't know. I think the animals are kicking in early. Anyway, let's keep this going.
And anyway, so Donocrates did travel with Alexander and was the guy who designed the city of Alexandria.
Nice. Good story. I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Paid off.
It did pay off. Yes. Little butt pain. You get to build a city.
So then after Vitruvius tells this story, he goes on to talk about how... Right. As all things are made up of atoms.
Here we go.
And he quotes Democritus as saying that atoms are bodies that cannot be cut up or are indivisible.
Nice.
So he knows his shit, Vitruvius. He does.
Well read.
He's read his Democritus.
Mm-hmm.
He then goes on to say that he thinks Democritus meant fire, water, and air as atoms. Mm. Buildings... He thinks that they are, you know, the things that are indivisible. Blocks. You can't. Have you ever tried to cut a piece of fire in half? No, you cannot.
No, that's true.
Can you cut water in half? You get some water. You try and cut it in half. It doesn't cut. It just goes. No. You go okay. Can't cut air in half.
No.
So he goes well because you know the Aristotelians said that everything was made up of the elements: fire, water, and air, and earth. I think was the other one they usually said. And he said, well, you know, that's really the same thing as what Democritus is saying, I think. Now, it wasn't.
Right. Still.
And if he had read his Lucretius, which had been written around about 60 and, you know, was probably out and around, and we know that people had copies of it in Augustus's time.
Yes.
He would have known how Lucretius explains the idea of atoms as being things that are so tiny that we can't see them.
Right.
Anyway, maybe they're tiny bits of fire, water, and air.
Could be. Who knows? We're not judging.
From his view. Yeah. I mean, fire is probably made up of really, really tiny bits of fire.
Fires know, you come put together.
Put fire under a microscope, you see baby fires.
I'm a fire.
Tiny little fires. These guys didn't know. But anyway, then he talks about how everything is made up of atoms.
Right.
Buildings, too. Are made up of certain kinds of basic elements.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta know what those basic elements are, and you need to put them together in the right order. He talks about bricks and how to make them.
Oh, nice.
He talks about sand. He talks about lime. And then he talks about something called pozzolana, which he describes as being deposits of volcanic ash used by the Romans in Italy at a place called Pozzuoli.
Right.
And he says you find this stuff near Mount Vesuvius.
Oh, shit.
Because, he says, it is related that in ancient times, the tides of heat swelling and overflowing from under Mount Vesuvius vomited forth fire from the mountain upon the neighboring country.
Yeah, it kind of did.
Apparently the people in Pompeii didn't read their Vitruvius. No. They should have read their Vitruvius.
Maybe we should move. Huh. What do you think? The land properties are going down. The value is going down for some reason. I don't know what it is. I don't know. Let's get out of here. Yeah. Gentrification. Anyway, yeah.
So people knew that there had been volcanic activity in the Pompeii area in ancient times, but obviously,
is it going to happen twice? Then. It's not going to happen twice.
No.
No, fuck, what are the odds?
What are the odds?
Yeah.
He talks about different kinds of stone. He talks about the different methods of building walls, different kinds of timber. You get the idea.
Yeah.
He goes detailed on
how to,
you know, all the things you need to know. Yeah, exactly. It's really, I found it really interesting, fascinating.
Ooh, architecture for dummies. That's what he did.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
That was the,
even
that was, that's
we
what
could use it. We could have used it. Yeah. That's how good it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to use it to build my next house.
I will go to a volcano and get you the right perfect rock. It'll be sweet.
I appreciate that.
It'll be a little warm, but it'll get the job done. Mm. Yeah.
Now, book three is how to design and build great temples.
Oh.
And he starts off by saying it's all about symmetry. You can't have a temple without symmetry.
That's
and
true.
Then he says this. Without symmetry and proportion, there can be no principles in the design of any temple. That is, if there is no precise relation between its members, as in the case of a well-shaped man.
Mm.
No, no, he's not talking about you, right?
No.
He said a well-shaped
I
man.
Thought you said misshaped. Okay, no, scratch that.
Not a pudgy little midget. No, he didn't.
It's unnecessary and yet still hurtful. It's in the contract. It's in the fucking contract. Anyway.
So then he says this.
Mm-hmm.
For the human body is so designed by nature that the face, from the chin to the top of the forehead and the lowest roots of the hair, is a tenth part of the whole height.
Oh.
The open hand from the wrist to the tip of the middle finger is just the same. The head, from the chin to the crown, is an eighth. And with the neck and shoulder, from the top of the breast to the lowest roots of the hair, is a sixth. From the middle of the breast to the summit of the crown is a fourth. If we take the height of the face itself, the distance from the bottom of the chin to the underside of the nostrils is one third of it. The nose, from the underside of the nostrils to a line between the eyebrows, is the same. From there to the lowest roots of the hair is also a third, comprising the forehead. The length of the foot is one sixth of the height of the body, of the forearm one fourth, and the breadth of the breast is also one fourth. The other members too have their own symmetrical proportions, and it was by employing them that the famous painters and sculptors of antiquity attained to great and endless renown.
Mm.
Now, I love the fact that he's writing this in, say, 25 BCE, and he's talking about the great painters and sculptors of antiquity.
Right.
Who was antiquity? Like, he's antiquity to us. What was antiquity to him?
Is that the ancient Greeks? I don't know.
Must be.
I guess.
Ancient Greeks.
The Etruscans?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
No, Etruscans didn't build much.
Oh, okay. I do know why it was important to have a temple built along the lines of a well-proportioned man. Because that way, it will be properly lined up with the heavens. So when you pray in the temple, the god, gods, whatever, he, she, it, they, trans, whatever, will be able to hear you better and hopefully answer your prayer. So that is how you honor the gods, by building the correct type of temple based off the example of a well-proportioned man, because the gods made man, so that makes sense to him. I mean, man is a thing of beauty. I guess the temple should be beautiful too, or at least well-proportioned in that sense of beauty. Horseshit. But anyway.
Well, that might...
anyway.
He then says that a temple should have similar harmony in its symmetrical relations. He writes, then again, in the human body, the central point is naturally the navel. For if a man be placed flat on his back, with his hands and feet extended, and a pair of compasses centered at his navel, the fingers and toes of his two hands and feet will touch the circumference of a circle described therefrom. And just as the human body yields a circular outline, so too a square figure may be found from it. For if we measure the distance from the soles of the feet to the top of the head and then apply that measure to the outstretched arms, the breadth will be found to be the same as the height, as in the case of plane surfaces which are perfectly square.
Right.
Therefore, since nature has designed the human body so that its members are duly proportioned to the frame as a whole, it appears that the ancients had good reason for their rule, that in perfect buildings the different members must be in exact symmetrical relations to the whole general scheme. Hence, while transmitting to us the proper arrangements for buildings of all kinds, they were particularly careful to do so in the case of temples of the gods, buildings in which merits and faults usually last forever.
Wow.
Now, I want to point out there, he said, since nature has designed the human body.
Right.
Not the gods have designed the human body.
Oh.
Nature has designed the human body.
Okay.
Mm.
Hey.
Yeah.
Just real quick, going back, we were saying a second ago about who would he consider the ancients, and of course, we're just guessing the Greeks, but there was this one video I saw in preparing for this, is that the ancient Greeks knew that their workers came from all over the place, and everybody's standard as far as measurements was different. So what the Greeks did was they literally carved a man standing, not unlike the Vitruvian man, against a wall, and it was like life size or whatever, and they all had to use that as a standard of measurement. And so they literally created their own standard of measurement. They carved it into stone so it would be there for a long time. And they say to the guys, look, I know you come from Judea, you come from wherever the fuck you come from, but when it comes to, if I say one arm length, look at the statue over there. If I say the height of a man or whatever, look at the carving in the wall over there. So again, that's pretty clever. So they had their own, they created their own standards of measurements. And so I thought that was neat. And so now he's coming along, and we don't have to go into this, but he goes into minute detail. Yeah, yeah.
Couldn't they just give him a piece of rope that was pre-measured, or a ruler, a stick?
I don't think that's, and I'm guessing here, honoring the gods, and it's not sexy. It's not fun. Here's some rope.
Yeah, but every time I go, oh, how long is this? What? Like five arm lengths?
No.
Five brachia?
Over the time.
Brachia? The rope I have to go back to the fucking sculpture on the wall.
Well, there was more than one
over there, and there figure out.
Look, I'm not Greek. Every time you tell me why. But it was a cool video. It was a cool video. Of course, it was a well proportioned.
Sounds like bullshit.
it's hurtful. Anyway,
hey Bobby, can I borrow your braccio rope? A one arm length rope. Give me your braccio. I mean, that's dimmy. Il braccio.
Right.
I don't know what rope is. I don't know what rope is in Italian.
No, that's Mexican. No, it's Spanish. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of cool. But anyway, so.
Did you have more?
Let's see. No, because the next thing I have, I think it might be something in your future. So, no.
Oh, you know what's going to happen in my future?
Ooh. If you keep fucking with me, I definitely know what's going to happen in your future.
You'll get Joe Biden to check my mobile phone records.
That's right. Oh, that would take like 12 seconds. Yeah, give me something harder. Anyway.
As Alberti, the Renaissance genius who wrote Di Pictura, and he also wrote his own version of Vitruvius's book, Di Architectura, he wrote in his own book, the harmony and concord of all the parts achieved in such a manner that nothing could be added or subtracted except for the worse.
Ah.
Reminds me of this. Up on my shelf here.
Right.
I have this. This is Dieter Rams's 10 Principles of Good Design.
Mm.
Know who Dieter Rams is?
I heard the name, but it doesn't mean anything to me.
Very, very famous German industrial designer, famously was the head designer at Braun for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his designs for Braun products ended up being stolen by Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive when they went back to Apple. Like this, I'm holding up a first-generation iPod to the screen.
That belongs in a museum.
Yeah, it is. It's in the Cameron Riley Museum. This is my first iPod. I bought this in 2004, like literally the day after I resigned from Microsoft. I went out and bought an iPod.
Right. Wow. Trade-off.
This is basically, you know, identical to a pocket radio that Braun, that Dieter Rams designed for Braun in like 1960.
Oh, wow.
But these are his 10 principles of good design.
Okay.
Number one, good design is innovative. Good design makes a product useful. Good design is aesthetic. Good design makes a product understandable.
Mm-hmm.
Good design is unobtrusive. Good design is honest. Good design is long-lasting. Good design is thorough down to the last detail. Good design is environmentally friendly. And number 10, good design is as little design as possible.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
Oh, I like so that. I think
that. Good design. Yeah, big D to Braun fan. In fact, I want to get a Braun watch. Okay, I was talking to you earlier about watches. Yeah. I'm looking at a Braun. I want to get like a classic Dieter Rams Braun watch and one of these days.
Unofficially, number 11 was friends don't steal from friends, but it didn't make the cut, so don't worry about it.
And then Vito goes on into a big discussion about the merits of using base 10 versus base 6.
Sure, sure.
Which was fascinating, or very interesting. But it's his description of the human body, obviously, that we're interested in today.
Right.
Now, we don't know what happened after Vitruvius finished his 10 books on architecture. We don't know if Augustus got a copy, if he read it, if it got distributed, if anyone gave a shit, if anything that was built in Rome had anything to do with Vitruvius's books. It could have ended up like my book on the psychopath epidemic, just was released, then the global pandemic hit and everyone went, books? Where we're going, we won't need books. And
Netflix and chill, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just fucking disappeared into a vacuum, despite spending 10 years working on it. It just, nothing.
That's beyond bad timing.
Most important book
right.
that came out in 2020, no one read it.
That is beyond bad timing. It's almost like there was a larger plan, larger force at work.
Yeah.
I don't know.
A plot.
I don't know.
It's the Jews, Ray. It's the Jews.
No!
Oh, I'm kidding, everyone. Jesus Christ.
On a completely unrelated question topic, why are the first couple of books in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, how come it's not Abdul, Muhammad? I don't know any names. Is that weird?
Because they were Greeks.
Oh. All right, cool. I didn't know that. Okay, I thought maybe it was just part of made up.
As you would know if you'd watched my film, right. the names that are on the books aren't necessarily the names of the people who wrote the books. We don't know who wrote the books.
Gotcha.
But yes, they were given names in the 3rd century, but they are Greek names because Paul's community, and they all came out of Paul's community, were Greeks. They were Gentiles. They weren't Jews. Jews didn't sign up for the whole thing. Jews, Judeans,
so we're good.
We're good. They were like, what's this bullshit you're talking about?
What's this latest fad? Fuck you.
Messiah? Fuck, that's not the Messiah.
I haven't
got
time for the Messiah. Yeah.
So Paul had to go find a new market and decided to figure out a way to market the Messiah to the Gentiles.
Nice.
Hence.
Yeah.
Ta-da! Anyway, back to Vitruvius.
Yes.
So no one knows what happens to it. One ancient source does report that late in his career, Vitruvius worked on the aqueducts of Rome, standardizing the size of the water pipes under the command of Agrippa.
Nice.
So he did get some sort of gig.
Right.
So Agrippa probably knew who he was, and if Agrippa knew who he was, Augustus probably knew who he was.
That's impressive.
He might have had some dinner parties. They may have read his book. They may have been fans, but we don't know. But one thing that does seem certain is that during his lifetime, Vitruvius didn't win any level of fame. He seems to have died in obscurity. There's not a single reference to him by a contemporary that has survived. Not that we have much written by his contemporaries, obviously. There's not a lot that survived that period, but we don't know anything about what happened to him.
But it's okay, because of the incel monks were making copies over the centuries of his book. He will survive through his book. He will be famous, kind of, for people like us. Through his books. That's something, right?
Yeah, that's what I tell myself.
That's right.
4 o'clock in the morning. It's okay.
Just wipe the tears away.
It's gonna, and your film.
It's going to be okay.
Yeah. Will.
Yeah.
Now, his book itself, his 10 books, nearly disappeared entirely from the historical record. Certainly for centuries after his death, there's no mention of them.
Yes.
It first reemerges in the 8th century.
Oh.
When a copy of it is lugged from Italy to England by an Anglo-Saxon abbot.
Right.
Named Ceolfrith.
Good name.
Apparently, the monks in England and Ireland, we know that the Irish were big on preserving works of literature.
Yes.
They were big fans of it for some reason. We don't know why, but they had a copy of it. He managed to find a copy in Italy and took it back to England.
Nice.
And the monks in right across medieval Europe did copy his books for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
One inventory records that 132 of the manuscripts survive.
Wow.
So it was unknown really in Italy broadly anyway, in sort of until Poggio discovered it in the 1300s.
Right.
But monasteries had copies of it. They just, no one knew they had copies of it because no one knew what the fuck they had in their, they were publishing their library catalogs, right?
Right. But
there are 132 manuscripts of it, which is astounding. That makes it probably one of the most copied books of anything from ancient antiquity. It's like Cicero, Aristotle, and Vitruvius.
Yes, that's pretty impressive.
Only two copies of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things, probably one of the most profound philosophical Stoic works ever written, at least that have survived, pretty much the only ones that survived, but it's profound, deep, beautiful. I talked about it at length in an earlier episode. Yeah. But there's only two of those we found.
Right. But
there's 132 copies of Vitruvius.
Right. Well, what do you think about the idea Lucretius was attacked, his writing was attacked by the church, so we're lucky that there were two copies left, whereas Vitruvius, I guess it's not a direct threat to the church, and so just keep copying and put it on the shelf, and when it starts to fall apart a couple hundred years, we'll make another copy of it. That's me guessing. It wasn't a threat.
Well, yeah, but why were they so interested in it is the question, because obviously they weren't interested in it from an architectural perspective.
Right.
They weren't following the principles of it.
Yeah, no one's building.
They weren't building great temples during the medieval period.
Right.
So what were they doing with these books? Now, according to one book I read, Da Vinci's Ghost by Toby Lester.
Right.
Who I want to try and get on the show. He's relatively young enough. Like a lot of these scholars are in their 90s by the time we're talking with him. I want to try and get him on, reach out to him.
Yeah.
One German monastery had he wrote this whole book, Da Vinci's Ghost. It's all about Vitruvian Man.
Right.
One German monastery had Vitruvius's books catalogued in the same company of the works by the church fathers, which suggests that if they were lumping it in with, the early writings of, Eusebius and Tertullian and these guys, that they classified it as a spiritual guide, not as a practical guide to building shit.
Right.
It was somehow a spiritual commentary.
Yeah.
And some of the earliest excerpts and summaries of the 10 books that have survived, dating from the 9th and 10th centuries, include the passage that I just read out on the dimensions of man, copied out in full.
Ah.
So according to Toby Lester's analysis on this, the form in which Vitruvius described the perfect man, the Christians probably saw as referencing Christ. Now, Vitruvius was probably referencing Augustus, they think, the perfect man, Augustus, who was, as people who have seen my film will know, who was called the Messiah. The Romans didn't use the term Messiah, but they said he called him the Savior, which means the same thing.
Right.
Some of the Christians who had this book probably liked this and saw it as, a ancient way of describing the perfect design, God's right. design of the perfect man, which they probably thought was Jesus.
Yeah. If I could just add to real quick, I watched an interview with Toby, and he said something like, the monks who were copying this out over the centuries did not really understand as well as Vitruvius did the geometry that was involved, but they did get it enough, and this is what you're alluding to, that it did allow them to contemplate the divine, the perfection through geometry of man as perfect. We're considering, you know, the proportional man is perfect. Obviously, it was made by God because God is perfect. He doesn't make mistakes. And so everything we have, we owe to God, yada, yada, yada. And then he said on the side note, they didn't really always get in garbled the parts when it comes to the Greek parts of the book, or when he was talking about something in Greek, or if it was written in Greek. But yeah, they liked that part of it because it was another way for them. It was one more thing for them to point out and go, see, this is God's hand at work. That might have been one other reason there were so many copies of it, you know, in the monasteries all over Europe.
Yeah, it's the same reason they kept Cicero and Aristotle. Mm. They saw them as... Well, they were pre-Jesus Christians.
They would have been, you know, Christians if... Yeah.
They would have been Christians. Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They got it. They got it, you know. They were...
All right, sorry.
But, yeah, now comparing Augustus and Jesus... Mm-hmm.
I'll take Augustus.
Each was the son of a god,
right?
Represented the cosmic ideal. Each, you know, held an empire together, mm-hmm. kind of symbolized or embodied the whole world,
right,
in their person. But other medieval libraries, Toby Lester says, placed alongside books about geometry and astronomy.
Oh.
So they saw something different in it. They actually kept it for its wisdom on how the world works,
right.
how to measure things. You know, so some of these monastic libraries were actually interested in maintaining the scientific legacy that mm-hmm. had been handed down.
Right.
But even after it was rediscovered by Poggio in Italy, not everyone was a fan. Alberti himself wrote, "What he handed down," Vitruvius he means, "was not refined, and his speech such that the Latins might think that he wanted to appear a Greek, while the Greeks would think that he babbled Latin."
Really?
Which is why Alberti wrote his own book on architecture. He thought he could do a better job. He thought he could improve on Vito's books.
It sounds like he's trying to trash Vitruvius so everybody buys his book. Because I do know that Alberti's book was the first theoretical book on the subject written in the Italian Renaissance, and in 1485 it becomes the first printed book on architecture. So it sounds to me like Stanna Barrier got involved and said, well, first of all, step one, and there's two steps to this, you son of a bitch. Step one is we have to trash the former author, and then we will, step two, and this is important, we will highlight your experience and work. So maybe it just sounds like he was trashing the guy that came before him because he wants, no, buy mine. It's new and it's improved and it's beautifully written. That's what that sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like us and Mike Duncan.
Right.
Vitruvius is Mike Duncan to us. Like, Mike Duncan's History of Rome.
Yeah.
Fucking yeah. Hold my beer.
What's that? What people keep saying, gold standard? I don't see it.
Yeah.
How many
dick jokes did he ever get?
No. Not enough, I can tell you that. Anyway, no. I digress.
All right. Well, I think that's where we'll leave this episode on Vitruvius, part two of our Vitruvius episode, which is part 20,000 of our Leonardo da Vinci episode. Yeah. Will be next week.
Yeah.